and welcome to British Eugenics. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. And my co-host is Max Musson from Western Spring. This is episode 7, where we will be looking at the effect the Second World War had on eugenics, and particularly on British eugenics. Okay, and we're going to begin with the Sterilisation Bill of 1931, which is, like, obviously at this time, the British government was more concerned with the British citizens and trying to do its best for them rather than doing what's best globally. The Sterilisation Bill of 1931 was introduced by Major A.G. Church, Labour MP for Wandsworth and organising secretary of the Eugenics Society, again, which shows that eugenics wasn't right-wing, it wasn't left-wing, it was just a sensible thing to be doing, basically. So you have a Labour MP here that's introducing this. It aimed to legalise the voluntary sterilisation of mental defectives. And, of course, the important part there is voluntary. This was not forced. And I dare say, if you had people that were really mentally defective, it would have to be their carers that were actually giving their consent. The bill was reproduced in a pamphlet entitled Better Unborn, which showed the consequences of encouraging fertility of dysgenic stocks. Open brackets, people with supposedly undesirable genetic characteristics, close brackets, with a view to garnering parliamentary and wider support. It was rejected by 167 votes to 89, the main opponents once again being Roman Catholics and Labour MPs, although most abstained. Among those who did vote for the bill were Eleanor Rathbone and Ellen Wilkinson. I think they're really sort of concentrating here on what we've talked about before, about how the purpose of doing this wasn't to harm people that were here, it wasn't to restrict their rights, it was to make sure that the next generation were born into healthy bodies with healthy minds. They didn't want to have people that were born into a body that would have to be looked after for the rest of their life because they were unfit, unable to take care of themselves, unable to really experience the fullness of what it means to be a human being. And I think that is implied with the title of the pamphlet here, Better Unborn. And I think also the important point to make here is that it was voluntary sterilization. It wasn't forcing this on people. It wasn't going out to all the people with a low IQ and holding them down and anaesthetizing them and giving them the snip. It wasn't anything like that. It was a suggestion for voluntary sterilization. And as I say, I think it would have been the carers that actually gave the consent for that. What do you make of the Sterilisation Bill of 1931, Max?
I think it would have been something which would have been well intended. I think, though, that where people it would have probably involved a sterilisation of people who probably would never have reproduced in any event. And I think that if they were reproducing, it would have been because they were in sanatoriums or hospitals of some sort where they weren't being properly they weren't being properly supervised, and so they were sort of people who were who lacked mental capacity were going off together as couples and having sex and then producing children. So I think as far as people in that category are concerned, then it would have been quite a sensible thing to do, because it would have then prevented further people with similar disabilities and incapacities being born. I don't think, though, that the that it would have actually had a wider effect than that, because people who lack mental capacity when they are at large in society probably would very rarely find anybody that would be willing to pair up with them as husband and wife or whatever, or to have children by them. So but it would improve the situation in institutions where people who were who lack mental capacity were perhaps sent and prevent them from, as I say, illicitly having children together when they shouldn't have been.
Yeah, I think it was probably more aimed at the inmates in the asylums. And it's interesting, the way that this was portrayed was that it was a right, actually, of the mentally defective, which sort of implies that they were engaging in sexual relations and they had a right to not have to force their mentally defective genes upon another generation. And this is because a parliamentary report known as the Brock Report of the Departmental Committee on Sterilisation of 1933 was unanimous in its conclusion that allowing and even encouraging mentally defective and mentally disordered patients to be sterilised was justified. So the parliamentary report actually advocated for this. Only 3 out of the 60 witnesses who gave evidence, comprising of psychiatrists, biologists, medical professionals, local authority representatives and social workers, were opposed to its recommendations on principle. So this wasn't about principle, this was basically about cause and effect and common sense. I mean, it's only logical, really, that you don't want people that are mentally defective to be creating lots of other people that are mentally defective. And the committee itself considers sterilization to be a right of the mentally defective and advocated extending it to those with physical disabilities as well. I mean, I'm quite surprised that this didn't actually manage to get through, considering it seems that most people were actually for this and they weren't actually considering rejecting it on principle, which is what the Roman Catholics were doing. I mean, they say that all life has a right to live, even if it is mentally defective and physically defective. And as I pointed out before, their reasoning for that is because they say that man is created in the image of God. Man is sacred, therefore all life is sacred. But if the life is going to be born mentally defective and physically defective, is that not a mockery of the image of God? And shouldn't it be an onus upon us to prevent that from happening? Shouldn't we be doing all we can to prevent that from happening? Which I think was the mentality that this parliamentary report had. Because they saw this as a right of the mentally defective to be able to have sex without then forcing that mental defectiveness onto the next generation. I think that was the way that they put this. What do you make of this, Max?
Well, I think I pretty much agree with you there that it's a matter, well, as I said earlier on, it's just really a matter of preventing people who lack mental capacity from reproducing in institutions, in my view. And I think that that's the perfectly healthy thing to do. I think if you have somebody who is so mentally affected that they can't lead a normal life, and so that they are effectively like small children or babies even. So you get some people who are so mentally damaged that they effectively, although they grow into a human sized person eventually, that they never acquire the mental capacity of even a 1 year old child in some cases, and so therefore they are completely helpless. And somebody who's in an institution in that sort of condition would be completely helpless, but they would have adult genitalia and adult bodies, and other people in the same institution could then take advantage of them, and there's no way that they could resist. And so, you know, it's in the interest of that person to be protected against unwanted pregnancies, or, you know, by having advantage taken of them. And in the discussions we've had about eugenics, I've said in the past that we shouldn't try to force people who might want to have families from having we shouldn't prevent them from having families. We should always we should just encourage people who've got undesirable mental or physical characteristics to have children at a below replacement level. You know, that I firmly believe, but there is a degree of mental deformity beyond which euthanasia probably would be the most appropriate thing to do. And I don't say this with any sort of easy heart, because it's always difficult to sort of suggest something like this. But the fact of the matter is, you sometimes see middle-aged couples pushing a pram around a town centre with what was one of their children in there, who is still no more advanced than a newborn baby would be, and where looking after that child has totally dominated the lives of those parents. And they've been lovely people. Despite the great deformity of their child, they've loved the child and they've done what they thought was the best thing by trying to raise that child themselves. In looking after a child of that size, with as incapacitated as a newborn baby, it's dominated their lives to the extent that it's in many cases prevented them from having holidays. It's prevented them from following the sort of careers that they would like to follow had they been able to. And in some cases, the child that is the problem is not their first child. It's perhaps their second child, and where it's their second child, the effort that parents have to invest in looking after the damaged child totally detracts from the quality of life that the healthy child that they had first of all should have expected to have. And so what happens is that the perpetuating the life of the damaged child effectively then severely limits and in some cases ruins the life of their parents and their siblings. And so, in that situation, there is a very strong argument for euthanasia, and parents should be able to feel that they can make that decision without being judged, in my view. In the situation that we're talking about here, where we're dealing with people that's, in my view, would primarily be people who would be in institutions, by applying a policy of sterilization, then that would be a less severe eugenic remedy. And one which should have been seen by everybody as being the most sensible thing to do.
Yeah, I think perhaps in some instances it might even be better that if that was a decision that was to be taken by the state in the instance that you're talking about there, Max. Because of the burden that it's going to place upon the people bringing up the child, they're not going to be able to contribute to the community. Obviously, the bringing up of any other children in the family is going to suffer because of it. But at the same time, then you would be saying that, well, the state shouldn't have the right to do that. It should be up to the parents. But again, on the other hand, the parents might find it difficult to make that decision, and it might be easier if it was made by the state. I guess these are the sort of ethical considerations that have to be discussed when you're talking about these sort of things. And I think one principle that you could say is that if somebody is not able to bring up a child, not able to care for a child themselves, then they should not have the right to have a child. That should not be inflicted upon a child to be brought up by somebody that is unable to bring a child up. If you had somebody in, for instance, in one of these asylums that was mentally disabled to the extent that they would be unable to raise a child, then they shouldn't be able to be put in that position where they have to raise a child, because obviously they're not going to. Somebody else is going to have to do it. And that just means that another generation is born with the same deformities, mental disabilities, or whatever the congenital problem is. Although it did not derail committed eugenicists from their belief in voluntary sterilization, the rise to power of the National Socialists in 1933 and the passing of compulsory sterilization legislation in Germany may have helped prevent such views from gaining traction in Britain. So in Germany, they brought in an act of compulsory sterilization for people that had congenital diseases. And in Britain, we were trying to bring in an act with voluntary sterilization, and the notes here put the voluntary in quote marks. And as I say, that's probably because these are the sort of people that wouldn't actually be able to give their own consent because they were that mentally disabled, but their carers would have been able to do that. Attempts in 1934 and 1937 to implement the report of the Brock Committee on Sterilization came to nothing. And remember, I mean, so that was the advice that was being given. After a parliamentary investigation, the report that was given was saying you should pass a bill for voluntary sterilization, and the government ignored the advice from their own committee. And widespread institutional sterilization of people with disabilities was not carried out in Britain. Meanwhile, the scientific credibility of eugenics was itself under increasing scrutiny. And again, I think that was due to World War II that took place shortly after that, and the negative promotion of the negative eugenics that was being carried out in Germany. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Yeah, that would have been the result of anti-German feeling would have caused people who were opponents of eugenics in this country to play on that anti-German feeling and say, oh, this is something that the Germans want to do, and so we should not want to do it because we're in opposition to the Germans. And it's as simple as that. The same thing happened in the United States. There was legislation in various states in the United States of America for voluntary sterilization, and I think in some cases compulsory sterilization. As a result of the Second World War, those people who were who were opposed to eugenics used the anti-German feeling that existed at the time in order to say, you know, we shouldn't do this because this is what the Germans do. You know, it's the silly argument that, you know, the Germans put their trousers on one leg at a time, so therefore we should try and jump into both legs of our trousers in one go kind of argument. You know, don't do the sensible thing because it's something that the Germans used to do.
Yeah, it's an argument that's still used today, isn't it? All the time against nationalists. And nationalists is something quite sensible, such as, you know, we have an issue with open borders and far too much immigration. And then if a politician says the same, he will get accused of being a white supremacist because it was the white supremacist who said something quite sensible, such as we have an immigration problem. And it was after the Second World War, really, that eugenics fell right out of favour, particularly in Britain. In 1945, the Eugenics Society stressed the gulf that separates eugenics from the Nazi doctrines of race hygiene and racial superiority. And that's an exact quote. So the Eugenics Society saw that what they wanted to do was completely different from the German policies. The aim was now to separate itself from, quote, perversions, unquote, of eugenics, and redirect attention to Sir Francis Galton's standpoint, which was not exactly unproblematic. In the same year, it repeated its commitment to the Brock Committee's recommendation on voluntary sterilization, and in this, it was starting to get increasingly out of step with mainstream thinking. So the Eugenics Society itself saw that what it was doing was completely different from the race hygiene and the racial superiority that was being talked about in Germany. Yet it was because of this that it sort of got tarred with the same brush, even though in Britain we were talking about voluntary sterilization, not enforced sterilization. I mean, there's a big difference there in the positive eugenics that Sir Francis Galton was talking about, and, you know, and state enforced sterilization. And I think euthanasia played into it as well. But also, I think in Germany, you had the financial cost of the war also led to some policies that maybe wouldn't have been put in place if they hadn't actually been in wartime, because the cost that it's going to cost for medical care and to look after the disabled when you're actually on a war footing, I mean, it could be said that that's a luxury that they just could not afford. So that may have sort of led to them having the enforced sterilization, perhaps enforced euthanasia, because they just didn't have the resources to look after these people when they had to put all their resources into defending the country, you know, in the middle of a world war. So I don't think we can what I'm saying, I think, is basically if Germany hadn't been on a war footing, perhaps they might have had slightly different policies. And instead of it being state enforced, perhaps maybe it would have been voluntary, as it was in Britain. But there was certainly a difference between the British view on this and the German view, I would have thought. Any thoughts on that, Max?
I think that different people will have slightly different ideas. The principle of eugenics is a sound idea. How radically you want to impose eugenic ideas on the society is a matter for sort of individual choice. But I think that as we've already agreed, a humane program of eugenics wouldn't involve compulsion other than in the most extreme cases, such as I've already described. Even as far as sterilization is concerned, it would not be something that you would force people to have if you were applying a humane program of eugenics. What tended to happen prior to the Second World War is that some of the people promoting eugenics did go a bit too far and did impose or try to advance legislation that would have made possible compulsory eugenic measures in situations where it wasn't, in my view, appropriate. And that combined with the anti-German feeling that grew up as a result of the Second World War just created the political climate where eugenics was discredited. But it wasn't discredited from an intellectual point of view. It was discredited from an emotional point of view because of the emotion of anti-German feeling rather than because in any academic sense, the need for eugenics or the benefits of eugenics had been discredited.
Yeah, it's all about benefiting the group rather than benefiting the individual. And that is ethical considerations that should be talked about and discussed. But when it all becomes about failings, you tend to forget about that. They're just sort of looking at it closely and, you know, how not very nice it would be for somebody not to be able to have children, instead of looking at the bigger picture of what that actually causes the burden on society if those children are going to be born with mental or physical infirmities.
When you consider that the royal family had to change their name from Battenberg to Windsor as a result of the anti-German feeling that grew up during the 20th century, if even the royal family had to change their name so that they couldn't be tarnished by any kind of association with Germany, it shows you the level of emotional the strength of emotions that would have been stirred up by people who were opponents of eugenics. And during the 20th century, particularly the early part of the 20th century, Roman Catholic population here in the UK was far more militant, and in view of the fact that the Roman Catholic religion is against any form of contraception, so therefore the anti-contraception argument and by definition also the anti-eugenics arguments would have figured highly and they would have worked very strenuously against them.
Yeah, we really shouldn't underestimate the strength of this anti-German feeling. In the 1950s, the society suggested the implementation of checks on West Indian immigration. It published Colin Bertram's Broadsheet on West Indian Immigration of 1958, the recommendations of which included so-called racist considerations of quotas for West Indians and testing for the quality of attributes of all immigrants. However, the society also reprinted scientific, anthropological, and cultural criticisms of Bertram's research. So the society was trying to portray both sides of the argument here. But why should it be considered racist? I guess because it's saying, well, you're discriminating against one racist of another when you're talking about quotas of West Indians. But then West Indians were a completely different race to the indigenous British. So quite clearly it should be considered that if you're going to import a group of people from a different race or from a different ethnicity, you have to consider the quota. You have to consider the percentage that there is that is going to be there in the country. I mean, you could say, well, you know, 0.5% or 1% non-white wouldn't be a problem in their own area, particularly in a capital city. Capital cities of the world have all different peoples in them by necessity for business and for that sort of thing. So you would think that it would be quite a sensible idea to say, well, you should have quotas, regardless of it being the Eugenics Society that is saying this. I should imagine they were probably saying it because of the chances of interbreeding, and interbreeding would obviously, that would be a negative on the integrity, on the ethnic integrity of the indigenous Britons, attesting for the quality of attributes. I mean, again, that I don't see how that could be considered racist, because you do test people for a job, don't you? Your job interview, you know, we test people at school, at education. You want people with the best qualifications to go on into university. So what this is suggesting here is that maybe IQ tests of immigrants to see whether they're going to be of benefit to a group of people with an average IQ of 100, for instance. So if you've got immigrants that have got an IQ of 65 or 70, then they're not really going to be of much help to a country with an average IQ of 100, are they? What they're going to end up doing is gradually bringing down the average IQ of the country, which is what we see happening. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Or because of the fact that they were not able to compete with the indigenous people on the basis of IQ, it would mean that they would end up doing less well-paid jobs. They would perhaps be more likely to end up being unemployed, and they would be quite likely to spend their entire lives complaining that they weren't being given the same rights as the indigenous people, which is pretty much what we've seen happen, that representatives of immigrant groups have spent their entire time since the time of the very first boats that were bringing immigrants into this country after the Second World War, all the way through to today, they have constantly complained and moaned about the fact that their people aren't achieving the success that is the expected level of success for the indigenous population, and that the thing that they're refusing to focus on is the quality and the qualities and the attributes of the people that compose those immigrant groups.
I think you make a very good point there. I mean, if they had actually tested for the quality of the West Indian immigrants, and by that I mean tested for the IQ, and they showed that they had an IQ of 75 or 80. Then that would have explained the reason why they had different outcomes to a people group with an average IQ of 100. And of course, they didn't do that. So then, of course, they say, well, what is the reason why these West Indian immigrants aren't doing so well as the indigenous British people? Well, it must be racism. Of course, if they'd actually tested for the quality, if they'd done IQ tests, they wouldn't have been able to say that. And of course, it isn't fair on them to be on a group with a lower average IQ to then be competing against a group with a higher average IQ. Quite clearly, that's not fair. But if you tell the groups that they're both equal to one another, then there's going to be resentment from both sides, isn't there? There's going to be resentment on the side that have the lower IQ, because they're being told that there's no difference between them and the group with the higher IQ, and the group with the higher IQ is going to end up resenting it because they're being told that they're the ones that are to blame for this, as if they're discriminating against the group with the lower IQ. So I mean, I think this was quite a sensible suggestion that the Eugenics Society were making, and because it wasn't implemented, because it was ignored, we have the growth of all this grievance culture and all this allegations of institutional racism that is responsible for these different outcomes. The eugenics movement in Britain peddled ideas that today seem offensive and downright dangerous, and had some prominent adherents. However, it never gained truly widespread appeal, and environmental and social reforms were increasingly seen as a more effective and humane remedy for social problems. As I say here, it didn't really gain widespread appeal, but it was intellectuals that supported it more so than anybody else because they understood it. Eugenics was also unsuccessful in its aim of stemming the fall in birth rates among those groups it deemed fitter, as women sought to control their own fertility by the use of contraception across many social groups. And I think the rise of feminism played a big part in that, in encouraging women not to have children and to go on and have careers, particularly the more intelligent women that you would have wanted to have large families. The Eugenics Society itself was renamed the Galton Institute in 1989 after Sir Francis Galton, and since then the organisation has sought to address questions raised by the scientific exploration of human heredity and to promote education and public engagement, not only with the current science but also with its origins and history. And in 2020, the UCL announced the redesignation of those parts of their premises that had been named in honour of Galton, Pearson and Fisher. Imagine that. I mean, these guys were responsible for the birth of statistics, great leaps forward in our understanding of heredity. I mean, these guys came out with laws of nature. And then you have the University of London, which is renaming places after them because they're so embarrassed about the findings that they actually made. It's not like they've said, well, we've come out with new theories and these new theories have been proved and they disprove the theories of Galton, Pearson and Fisher. They're just saying because their ideas are offensive, we have to get rid of them. We have to cancel them. You know, some of the most intelligent people that we ever had. And this is, you know, this is the reason why eugenics isn't really looked into. And as we've said all along, there's positive eugenics, there's negative eugenics, but the whole idea of it is about improving the lives for the next generation. It's quite a selfless way of doing things. And people might say, well, it's not these intelligent people that are being encouraged not to breed. But as you've pointed out, Max, it would just have to be if they just had one child instead of two. And then through the generations, you would end up with less and less people that had these less desirable characteristics. It's a great shame that these organisations are so embarrassed by the people that actually came up with all these ideas in the first place. I think, Max, what do you make of them renaming the Eugenics Institute and then renaming everything that was named after them?
Well, I think that's it's a terrible thing that's being done. The what we have to accept is that moral standards that apply will differ in different ages, and that you shouldn't try and judge people from the past against current day moral standards. The fact of the matter is, though, that even that argument is made insignificant by the argument that that various of these people that have been cancelled and where buildings have been renamed so that they're not named after them were people who not only provided great leaps forward for our understanding in terms of science, etc., but are people who applied their own personal fortune to creating the institutions that are now cancelling them and renaming the buildings, etc., that were originally named in their honour. And I think that particularly is iniquitous because, you know, if you don't want to be associated with a person because of what they did during their lifetime, then you should at least have the integrity to donate the money that they gave you to organisations that do support the things that those people wanted during their lifetime. So that, organisations like the UCL, they want to have the benefit of the money that was given to them by these great Britons. But they don't want to. But they then want to disassociate themselves from those people, so that nobody thinks that they may have any sympathy with them whatsoever. It's like somebody waiting until their parent has died, and that the parent's estate is then passed on to them in their will, and then publicly denouncing their parent in every possible way as somebody who was to be disparaged. It's just really, really bad form. It's a terrible thing to do. If you don't want to dignify your parent, or you don't want to dignify the person who's provided the money to enable your institution to be created and to function, then you should give the money back and give it to somebody who will honour the parent, or who will honour the institution.
I think society needs to be objective and politically neutral, or politically blind as well. Otherwise, it's not science, is it? If it's being affected by political correctness, political sensibilities, then it's no longer being objective. It's no longer finding out exactly the way that the world works, because you're not looking at that anymore, because you're concerned of how it might hurt somebody's feelings. So we'll just pretend that the world isn't the way that it is, because it might hurt somebody else's feelings if we do describe how it actually is. I mean, it's scandalous, really, to have science affected like this. And that is what we're seeing. Political correctness is really hampering science today. If any studies actually turn out with any information that could be considered to hurt the feelings of any minorities, then that study is not going to get published. It's not going to get talked about. It's not going to get funding. And yet there are differences between all the different groups, and the anthropology should be the study of that, should be the study of these differences. And yet anthropology today just completely has its hands tied. And yet all this information is coming out there, particularly through DNA research, showing the link between genetics and intelligence. I think it was the guy that actually first came out with DNA. He ended up being cancelled for saying that there were these differences between people groups, and that is what all this boils down to. Basically, it's political correctness, and that putting a stop to the science that we have, and also discrediting the names of these great people that made possible these great leaps forwards, particularly Galton and Pearson, and with the use of statistics. Well, that pretty much finishes with the section on British eugenics. We'll start another section on eugenics in the next episode. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for more presentations on the science of eugenics right here at RadioAlbion.com.